Hello, and welcome to the Revolutionary Action Dance Party, produced out of CHSR-FM in Fredericton. I'm Pierre Loisel. On March 22, 2001, Dr. Roland Christjohn spoke at St. Thomas University during Native Awareness Days. His talk is entitled, The World Conference Against Racism, Canada's Loud Silence.
Anybody who's going to Durban, South Africa with the idea of doing something useful for Indigenous people had better be well prepared psychically, psychologically, materially, and analytically for what they're likely to encounter.
Dr. Roland Christjohn, the Director of Native Studies at St. Thomas University, is co-author of The Circle Game, Shadows and Substance in the Indian Residential School Experience in Canada. An Oneida of the Iroquois Confederacy, he has had much experience and has written extensively about social issues which affect Indigenous peoples of North America. Without further ado, let's join Dr. Roland Christjohn with The World Conference Against Racism, Canada's Loud Silence.
Tonight I'm going to talk about the World Conference Against Racism. Not the whole thing, because I'm not interested in the whole thing. I'm interested in parts of it because, for one thing, I have been working in the field of racism for 30 years or more. I have been asked twice now by Heritage Canada to come and put my two cents in concerning Canada's preparation. The title of my talk is Loud Silence, Canada's Preparation for the World Conference Against Racism. And I call it a loud silence because while Canada seems to be doing quite a bit, I mean, they've held six regional conferences, they've held one national roll-up conference. I was at the regional conference in Halifax and the national roll-up conference in Ottawa just last month. They're planning at least one more conference in Winnipeg. The date of that keeps shifting. I don't know if I'm going to get invited to that. I strongly suspect I won't, but I didn't really expect to get invited to this one either, so that was a bit of a surprise. Why do they keep asking me to come, and what is it that I've been doing when I go there? And why do I say that Canada's preparation for the World Conference Against Racism is a loud silence? It's a loud silence because they're doing a lot of activity. Go to their website. Go to Heritage Canada's website. There's a ton of material. It's all downloadable. You can chat with other people, you can look at their documents, you can look at the non-governmental offices that are preparing papers and so on. So there's a lot of busy work, there's a lot of paper. My only difficulty is that I don't see what any of it has to do with racism. So it's dithering of a sort, and it's dithering a kind of dithering that makes it look like they're dealing with the issues of racism, but by avoiding it, it turns into a very loud silence about racism. And I want to document that tonight, maybe not so much spend so much time documenting it, because I've brought it up once or twice before. I was here last November talking about my experiences in Halifax in September. So now I'm here in March talking to you about my experiences in Ottawa in February. What has changed between September and February? The answer is nothing. Interesting, when I went to Halifax, just to give you a very brief summary, what I did is I tried to throw a monkey wrench into the thing. That what Canada was saying was this was a consultation, a regional consultation. What they were going to do was consult with interested Native individuals and organizations, take the recommendations and roll them up into the document that was being prepared for delivery at the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa in August and September of the year 2001. What I said then, and what I was able to convince a lot of the other people who are indigenous people who were attending that conference, what I said then was that this was a pseudo-consultation, that Canada had absolutely no intention of taking what we had to say seriously. They wanted to be able to put down on paper that they had met with indigenous peoples, indigenous representatives, that they had taken their input under advisement, and then go right ahead and say what it is that they were going to say anyway in the first place. I convinced, and it wasn't just me, but I convinced the group as a whole to repudiate the process, that we weren't there for that, we didn't represent people, we didn't have any authority to speak, and that if you really wanted to hear what we had to say on racism, get out of the way. The people who were invited to that were largely a hodgepodge. There were a whole bunch of people who felt more than a little out of place there, but see, I have a bad habit. If you ask me to come and ask me for my opinion, I will give it to you. Generally, my opinion is one that I have thought of, and racism is something, like I say, I've been working in and around for 30 years or more. So I'm perfectly willing to shoot my mouth off about that. It's not like I have a totally uninformed, misinformed opinion. And what I was hoping is to say, look, what we can pass as a resolution here is that this isn't a consultation, and what the Heritage Canada, if they're serious about fighting racism in Canada, what they should be doing is not trying to figure out how they can co-opt us and put words into our mouth, but how they can support us, and I don't mean how they can support the Assembly of First Nations or how they can support Roland Christian either, but how they can support Indigenous interests, Indigenous nations, traditional and non-traditional in Canada, to stand up and say what has to be said about racism in Canada. We actually did pass it as a resolution. And I kind of thought, well, you know, it's a good effort. I wish that I could have the sense that I was doing more than simply talking to myself or talking to a very small group of people there in Halifax. One thing that going to these conferences, the World Conference Against Racism, is my bag full of papers from the Heritage Canada continues to get larger and larger. So I got another, I think, about 20, 25 pounds of paper. And there was actually some interesting stuff in there this time. The last time it was all entirely Heritage Canada this and Heritage Canada that. Well, there were a few summaries from other places. The Aboriginal caucuses in Vancouver and the Aboriginal caucus in Toronto both stood up and did more or less what we did in Halifax, which is to say, this isn't a consultation. It does not count as a consultation. If Heritage Canada is serious about dealing with this, then give us the money, make it possible for us to develop our own positions on the problem of racism in Canada, and get out of the way. And I was quite proud of that. I was scared. I mean, it is quite a scary situation, because it's eminently possible that you are completely out of your mind, that you're only the only gibbering idiot on this, and it's nice to know that if I'm a gibbering idiot, I am not the only one. They also inhabit Vancouver and Toronto. They were making the same kind of argument in the same kind of sense, the way that I was. And very shortly at Ottawa, by going through the WCAR papers, I realized that I was not by myself. So I looked forward to the process, okay, well, maybe something's actually going to happen in Ottawa. Now, before I get to exactly what happened in Ottawa, I should tell you a little bit about what's happening with the WCAR. You probably heard, well, maybe you have and maybe you haven't, that the WCAR, the World Conference Against Racism, is in trouble itself, entirely in and of itself. Just last week, the United States announced that they're probably not going to go at all. And the reason that they're not going to go at all is because there's not a problem of racism in the United States. Sounds extraordinary, but then you begin realizing what some of the non-governmental offices are angling for in the United States. By the way, I can't find anything specifically by Aboriginal peoples, First Nations peoples in the United States, but I do see a lot of what the black caucuses are talking about in the United States. What they are talking about are reparations. What the federal government of the United States, what American industry owes black people for the history of slavery and exploitation and discrimination starting oddly enough, with 1492, and the discrimination part of it continuing to this very day. They are talking about, let's start opening the bank accounts, the checkbooks, and start paying people back for the historic injustices suffered by black people at the hands of the American governments and American peoples. So you begin to get some idea of the United States' official disinterest in running off to a forum where a significant proportion of their people anyway are going to be able to stand up and kick the living daylights out of them publicly. They're probably not all that interested. So on that basis, it looks like the United States may be backing out of participation in the WCAR. Another factor in not only the United States pulling out of the WCAR, but a whole bunch of countries pulling out of the WCAR officially, is that some countries are pushing the formulation of Zionism as equal to racism. It is a real point as to whether or not the kinds of discriminations against Palestinian peoples in their own countries, where they're routinely subject to search and seizure and torture and other kinds of things that the Israeli government is perfectly willing to acknowledge, does that constitute racism as an issue defined in the terms that the World Conference Against Racism is going to discuss racism? That is another incentive for the United States not to want to go to the World Conference Against Racism to give any legitimacy whatsoever to those kinds of arguments. The Israel is a client state of the United States, and they have consistently supported whatever the Israelis choose to do in dealing with the issues of the Israelis and the Palestinian peoples. Canada itself has a commitment along those lines. So how that's going to play itself out, nobody knows right now. People are trying to gauge the extent to which that's going to take over the World Conference Against Racism as a forum for bringing up those kinds of issues, and some people are making their judgments, some countries are making their judgments whether or not to participate on the basis of the danger that they see lurking in allowing a public airing of those kinds of issues. A third factor in the self-deconstruction, I call it, of the World Conference Against Racism is that the African nations and India and even Asian nations are beginning to put together the notion of, well, if the American blacks can talk about reparations for slavery, we should be able to talk about reparations from Europe for 200 plus years of colonial exploitation worldwide. With respect to the African subcontinent and the Indian subcontinent and Asia and South America and Central America and North America are all issues that at least certain groups want to bring up and say, look, you've got not only spent 200 years exploiting us economically, you now have us under your economic thumb, such that we have to destroy our own internal economies in order to pay off a debt that we are never going to be able to pay off. Where is the remission of those loans? Where is the reparation for the destruction to our ways of life? That was imperialism, that was colonialism, that was racism. We want to discuss that at the World Conference Against Racism. Suddenly, a whole bunch of European countries are wondering whether or not they want to go and hear the story of the economic exploitation of what we euphemistically now call the Third World, historically and in present-day terms. What are they worried about? What they worried about is that some people are talking about racism not as a felt experience of evil-minded people, but of a system of inherently unequal economic relations and institutions that exist to support those inherently unequal economic relation systems. And it doesn't come down to criminal intent on the part of a bad, bad man, or even a bad, bad woman. But it comes down to the fact that things have been arranged in this world that certain people are going to consistently be falling behind certain other people. That the people that got are going to keep and get more, and the people who don't have are going to be kept from getting any. That is more like what I was talking about last November. That's closer to an institutional analysis than it is to an analysis of racism as is currently favored in most Western European and North American mainstream countries, and that is racism as an emotional, attitudinal experience of some sort. That's all prologue, because they're going to argue about their things, and they're going to make their resolutions, and the World Conference Against Racism is going to implode or not, I think, based on its own qualities, their own resolution of those issues. But what I want to talk about is, what did I run into? You know, I have thoughts and feelings about, you know, the Third World and Africa and even Palestinian issues and Kosovo and Azerbaijanis and the Armenian Holocaust and so on and so on. I've read about them. I have opinions about them. But time and time again, what I have to bring myself back to is the situation in Canada. The Canadian situation, Canada, in my opinion, has its own form of racism. And that form of racism is generally not talked about or thought about or read or discussed. As a matter of fact, thinking of the Canadian variation of racism is astutely avoided as any kind of topic of polite conversation. So while I can certainly sympathize with other people's struggles elsewhere in the world, I have to keep coming back to what I consider to be a fact. And that fact is that Canadian racism is alive and well, and that if I want to change the world, I should try to change my part of it first, before I presume to go around and tell other people what they should think and what they should do. I should try to do what I can to put what I consider to be my own house, in the broadest possible sense, in order. So as long as there are problems to be resolved here, I don't think I have any place telling anybody else how they should think about things and what they should do about them. I'm committed to thinking about the status of First Nations people, Indigenous peoples, and North American Canadian society, and what our current institutional arrangements mean for us. What is the long run of what's going on to us, and what can I do to put things in a direction that I consider right? What did I run into in Ottawa? Well, I began to realize very quickly why I was invited to Ottawa. Because if I was in any way dangerous in Halifax, I was not dangerous at all in Ottawa. That between the time that they actually let a wordy academic into the conversation about the World Conference Against Racism in Halifax, they had established a process between Halifax and Ottawa, between the time period, that made sure that I would have absolutely no chance to say what I had to say. I was talking to another faculty member here just the other day, and she was saying the same thing about a conference that she got invited to in Halifax. She was interested in working with immigrant groups and so on and discussing possibilities. And once she got in there, she realized that the federal government had such a lock on who was going to talk about what and how they were going to talk about it, that what was happening was that they were simply being told what was going to happen. They were being lectured to. She felt like a little two-year-old kindergartner who had misbehaved because she kept wanting to talk about substantive issues. And I said, feels pretty bad, doesn't it? Welcome to the club. That's the kind of experience that I've gone through regularly. This wasn't the first time I'd been marginalized like this. But it was the Canadian federal ministries and even the provincial ones get better and better at doing it. So what had happened? I analyzed it in terms of several general problems. First problem was the professionalization of functionaries, I call it. Professionalization of functionaries. What do I mean by that? Well, there's a whole bunch of people who are going to the World Conference Against Racism. It's not just governments. A lot of what are called NGOs, non-governmental offices, are applying for credentials, and they are producing papers. The Canadian government, as a matter of fact, I got a stack of those. Well, it's about 20 papers that were commissioned by Heritage Canada of several non-governmental offices. There's a paper on reparations. There's a paper on women's rights. There's a paper on the elderly, and so on and so on, that were done not by the Canadian government, but were commissioned by Heritage Canada, dealt out to non-governmental offices who produced those papers, who put them on a table. When you did your check-in, you got your copy of the of that packet of papers, and they're all sitting in there. The interesting thing is that Those NGOs are supposed to be arm's length, and they're not. They're not in the following ways. The first thing is that often the non-governmental offices are run by former participants, civil servants, or governmental members. They're consulting agencies, that they just have friends that they used to work for a particular department, and they still have friends that are working for a department. They're also not arm's length in the sense that they do not disagree with the fundamental ideologies that are involved. And I'll go into that in a little bit more detail later. But what I would argue, in reading through some of the papers that were provided to us, is that while I have severe criticisms of the Heritage Canada's position on racism in Canada, I see exactly the same position on racism reflected in the work that's being produced by the non-governmental offices. It's an interesting fact about having an ideological grip on people, is that people take things that aren't factual as the basis of fact. They start there. They accept without argument the precepts of somebody else's vision of the way the world is. And gee, if you accept somebody else's premises of an argument, you end up with the same conclusions, if you're rational, if you're logical. To the extent that Canada has successfully eliminated differing views of what the nature of racism in Canada is, then it really doesn't matter whether or not a governmental office or a non-governmental office produces a position paper on the problem of racism. They will end up saying exactly the same thing. So the arm's length aspect of it is simply because there's not a direct payment from the federal government in terms of a federal budgeted salary to the individual or individuals producing the paper, but the ideological correspondence is complete. Thirdly, the other aspects of the provincializations of the functionaries was the various advisory bodies that were struck by Heritage Canada. I wasn't ever invited to be on an advisory body, and I have to say that even if I was, I would have said no. So they probably knew that, and it was a waste of time. But there are advisory bodies for Black Atlantic people and elderly people and Native people and et cetera, et cetera. And the people who were invited to be members of the advisory bodies turn out to do what? Now, these aren't governmental offices, and they're not people who work for governments. But they are selected by governments. And while I know quite a few of the people who are on the Indigenous Peoples Advisory Body, I also know something else about them, and that is they don't understand the nature of what the difficulty is. Many of them were higher-level functionaries in the execution of the report on the Royal Commission of Aboriginal Peoples. As much as people stand up and talk about why aren't we implementing the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People, and isn't it a crime that Canada's not doing it, having read the report of the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, it is my conclusion is that it is not a favorable thing to Indigenous peoples. It is a furtherance of the attack that I'll identify later in this talk, that it's exactly the same attack all over again. The fact that the advisory bodies to Heritage Canada on the issue of racism are also made up of these people who helped produce the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples report, to me, is not a good thing, because if they had any critical consciousness of what was going on, it would have appeared in the Royal Commission report back in 1996. People can change in 5 years, but people generally don't change in 5 years, particularly when they're being well paid not to change in that period. So these advisory committees, who are supposed to be putting, information into the ear of Hedy Fry, are largely saying things that she wants them to say anyway. But these advisory councils are not any more arm's length than the government itself or the non-governmental offices. And finally, a lot of the purely, supposedly, completely arm's length organizations, they themselves, like I say, I've said already before, fall within the same ideology. There's a group called the Canadian Race Relations Foundation. They were very prominent there. They do race work. They had all of their documents up. One of the documents is unequal access. And it documents, that Indians simply aren't on a level playing field. They're not being given the same opportunities as everybody else, as well as Black people, as well as immigrants, as well as other elderly people and women and youth and so on, other discriminated groups in Canada. that the point of all of that is that the same ideology, again, that I will go on to talk about a little bit later, is present in that, those reports also. The absence of critical thinking concerning racism, as far as I could tell, in terms of the governmental functionaries, is absolute. I saw nothing in there that I would say, here's something that Roland Christian might say, or somebody who is interested in a position at least similar to Roland Christian might say, or that Sivanandan might say, or that Richard Lewontin might say, or any of a dozen people I could name who've been working for years and years and years in race relations, but do not fall into the kinds of traps that if Heritage Canada is not setting them, they are certainly falling into. For better or worse, the Canadian Race Relations Foundation is another one of those organizations that fall into that. A second general problem that I ran into is the problem of, I call of the problem of the Byzantine eunuchs. Well, the Byzantine eunuchs. Well, you remember, maybe you don't remember, but toward the end of the Eastern Roman Empire, the palaces of Constantinople, getting access to the emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire, or whatever, was a matter of genuflecting the right way and meeting this protocol eunuch, and this beautiful protocol eunuch would introduce you to that protocol eunuch, and you had to walk sideways this way and go like this three times and whatever. And if you didn't go through all these ceremonies exactly properly, you had to start all over again. And you only had like 30 people to get past in order to get somebody that was actually capable of doing anything. And what happens is that, you know, if you get your city attacked under those circumstances, it's a 3 or 4 days before anybody who is in authority to do something about it actually finds out, because there are just too many Byzantine eunuchs in between the action that has to report it and the actual reporting of the information to somebody who can do something about it. I ran into a lot of Byzantine eunuchs in Ottawa. These Byzantine eunuchs were not just Byzantine eunuchs who were working for the government of Canada. Some of them were working for the United Nations. They were there. They were very popular. The Byzantine eunuchs were very popular because the Byzantine eunuchs were telling people, this is how you apply for NGO status. If you want to go to the conference in South Africa, well, you're not going to go to that conference in South Africa, and you're certainly not going to get a chance to say anything unless you genuflect the proper way to the right people. Now, if you want to get money to go, well, we have forms for that, but these forms have to be filled out a particular way, and the head eunuch over there must carry it to the head eunuch over there, and then they're going to do something with it with other eunuchs, but you're not going to see that. The most popular people in Ottawa, I found, were these eunuchs. Now, I'm saying this metaphorically. I really don't know their their intactness status. But they were experts in the protocol of how the conference in Durban, South Africa is being organized. If you want to become a non-governmental officer, or want your group to become an NGO, which means that you can then apply for funds that will help defray the cost of you going, which means if you go to this other committee, you get a chance to make a preliminary proposal to that, which will decide which of the NGOs are actually going to get time during the General Assembly to stand up and make their point. And by the way, nobody's going to get more than 15 minutes. The Government of Canada is going to get 15 minutes to stand up and make its report. If you genuflect properly, if you do perform the ceremonies properly, you too might get your 15 minutes in the plenary session. Okay? The people who know how to do this work for the United Nations or work for the government, but work for the government by interacting with the United Nations. And there was even one guy who worked for the Assembly of First Nations, who works with the United Nations, who works with the government of Canada. He was the most popular guy in the room, because he knew, well, you're not doing the genuflect properly. You have to get that paper and genuflect this way, and so on. He was very popular. So the Byzantine eunuchs had pretty well taken over the process. It had become bureaucratized. Between me shooting off my mouth in Halifax and me attempting to shoot off my mouth in Ottawa, there had been a eunuch barrier erected. And nobody was going to get a chance to say anything to anybody unless a eunuch had given them permission. There's a lot of talk about credentials, how to apply for travel funds, how to win time on the podium. There was absolutely no talk, none, about what anybody was going to say once they had their 15 minutes. It was all, how do you get your 15 minutes? I heard not one word in 3 days of conferencing about what it is that anybody should say about it. Got your 15 minutes? I'm going to dance. I'll sing the dream, the impossible dream. The big technique is just to get their attention and then worry about whether or not you got anything interesting to say. There was no talk about what was interesting to say. Finally, there was a heck of a lot of talk about what I call speaking for but not speaking. This was another way to make sure that I'd have absolutely nothing to say in Ottawa. Almost everybody, we had a little room. It was actually smaller. I've complained last November that they put us in a tiny little room out in Halifax. They stuck all the Indians in a tiny little room. We had more Indians this time than we had in Halifax, and we had a smaller room. So maybe, they were getting wiser. Certainly everybody was sitting on top of each other. But as we go around and introduce yourself in the room, it all became one of these ceremonies of, I'm so-and-so, and I speak for such-and-such. And the bigger the number of people that you represented, the more credibility you're given. I speak for the Assembly of First Nations. I speak for the Atlantic Chiefs. I speak for the Métis Association, and so on and so on. Roland Christian? Well, I'm Roland Christian, and I just talk for myself when I get around to it. I mean, who do I represent? I don't even represent my damn department. I wouldn't presume to. Andrea and Sheldon have mouths. They want to say something, they certainly well can talk. Who do I represent? Maybe me, if I'm thoughtful about something. And here, racism is something I pretend to be thoughtful about anyway. So I'm here representing me. Oh, he's only representing him. Suddenly you begin to realize the large Indian organizations are the ones that are supposed to be preparing the Indian position, or the Indigenous position, or the Métis position. It's certainly not the lonely academic sitting in the wilderness just thinking about the topic, reading it, doing historical analysis, trying to put two and two together, and so on. Since nobody's talking about the content of what's being said, that kind of thing is useless anyway. It is a matter of the proper protocol, following functions and speaking for lots of people and not actually speaking. So those were some of the general problems. Sitting around talking with the Indians, I also ran into what I call derivative problems. These derivative problems are related to the eunuch barrier that's erected and the speaking for but not speaking problem that I talked about earlier, and the professionalization of the functionaries. The first problem that I noticed sitting with the self-proclaimed Aboriginal caucus was that they were looking to the World Conference Against Racism but not looking past it. Think about it for a moment. Since all of their energies were involved in how do we get NGO status, how do we get travel funds that will help us travel there, how do we get in front of the committee that's going to allocate time at the plenary session, since they were doing all of that, their aim is at what? Getting to Durban, South Africa, talking their 15 minutes, schmoozing their schmooze, and getting on their plane and coming back. To me, Durban, South Africa is, in a certain kind of way, an irrelevancy. The first question I have is, do you really think, even in the best case scenario that we can imagine, that the world is going to send representatives to Durban, South Africa in August and September of this coming year, and after a week or 10 days, we'll solve the problem of racism. We're done. Thank God we had this conference. We had a chance to smooth it all out. Now the people are going to go back to their individual countries with this list of things to do, and there won't be any racism anymore. Whew. Thank goodness. Glad we got that one done. Now we have to start worrying about this other problem. Let's wipe out crime. Let's wipe out disease. But we got racism out of the way. Well, I mean, I'm not trying to spritz the United Nations, but the United Nations does not, by declaration, by conference, eliminate problems. Sometimes they do in little ways. Sometimes they make them worse. Sometimes what they're doing is irrelevant. When is what they're doing most likely to be irrelevant? When what they're doing is contrary to the interests of the United States. The United States doesn't have any part of it, then it doesn't really matter what the United Nations says. They can claim that the mining of harbors in El Salvador is a war crime, and the United States just says, we're going to do it anyway. George Bush Sr. doesn't go to jail. Ronald Reagan doesn't go to jail. Nobody gets charged with any kind of crime there. The United States just ignores it. The United States doesn't like what the United Nations Genocide Convention does. They exempt themselves. It's right in their own legislation. So the United Nations can say a lot of things in Durban, South Africa. If anybody seriously believes they're going to resolve the problem of racism in Durban, South Africa in 10 days, what planet are you from? If you're not looking past what happens in Durban, South Africa, then I don't know what version of reality you can possibly be operating by. At best, Durban, South Africa, in the best of all possible worlds, can be a beginning of some sort. But you have to be planning for a long haul here and not for a short-term solution. The second thing that I got, and I very seriously got this impression that from particularly the members of the Assembly of First Nations, there wasn't anybody from the Assembly of First Nations in Halifax. As near as I can tell, there wasn't anybody from the Assembly of First Nations to Vancouver or Edmonton or Toronto and so on. It wasn't until they suddenly realized that the Heritage Canada was going to stick something up in Ottawa and the hiring of a couple of people with a little bit more on the ball in racism that suddenly the Assembly of First Nations began to sense a bandwagon forming. And what I mean by that is it's just like during the French Revolution, the fellow was saying, there goes my people, I must put myself in front of them, I'm their leader. The Assembly of First Nations were not interested in what was going on until suddenly they realized, A, that the World Conference Against Racism is going to be a big thing as far as Canada's concerned. Canada's making a fuss about it. One of the reasons that Jean Chrétien is protecting Eddie Frey in Parliament today and will do until the other parliamentarians get tired of attacking Eddie Frey is that it's a bit late in the game for Canada to replace what it considers to be its key player. Hetty Frye is supposed to be going to Durban, South Africa, and she's supposed to be presenting the Canadian position there. She's been working all the way through there. Canada wants to stand up and say, look, we're another model country. You guys have problems with racism there. You got problems with racism here. We got it all under control. We've got such a wonderful, wonderful country. There isn't any racism in Canada, and here's Hetty Frye to tell you. They're all set to do that. Well, the Assembly of First Nations realize that Canada's got a big role up to this. The Assembly of First Nations suddenly sees that, there go my people. We're their leaders. We've got to get in front of this mob. What happened at Vancouver and Toronto and in Halifax was that people who are a lot closer to the grassroots than the upper-level functionaries of either the Canadian or the First Nations governments got down and dirty and said what was happening was wrong and that some fundamental things needed to be changed. Somebody at the Assembly of First Nations has picked up on that and they've decided, yes, we're going to be a player here. And so there's an interest there. And what is that interest? Is the interest simply one that somebody else has defined an issue for them and something that they believe they should be ideologically committed to and consequently are willing to work for? Well, maybe there's a part to that, but there's also a part for it that there's money to be made here. That what's likely to come out of Durban, South Africa is a series of initiatives, programs that are supposed to be undertaken here, there, and wherever. And the Assembly of First Nations, like any good exploiter of First Nations people in Canada, can smell money. Racism? Is there money in that? Heritage Canada's throwing money at racism. Canadian government's throwing money at racism. Oh, well, there's money for racism. Is it impossible that Indian representatives might not really know what's going on and what to do about it? No, it's not impossible that they know. Is it likely, however? And my answer again has to be, no, it's not likely. Why? Because the problem of racism, at least the kind of discussion that I would prefer to have racism, is a lot more subtle than bad people doing evil things. It's a lot more subtle than that. And since I don't see anybody talking about that, I can't see that it's going to be an act of God or a bolt of lightning is going to strike somebody and suddenly enlightenment is going to come. That unless people sit down and actually do spend time substantively working out the issues, they're simply not going to work it through. Since that didn't take place in Ottawa, and again, like I say, I didn't see any chance that it was going to take place in the near future with Ottawa, is it likely that they're going to have this kind of a breakthrough? And all I can say is I don't think so. I think it's much more likely that they're going to be blindsided on it. And when I say that, I speak from experience. They just got blindsided again with respect to the residential school this last week. Andrea brought me in some papers that showed once again that the churches and the government are willing to do every dirty, underhanded trick to remove residential schools and the issues that arise from it, or to put a particular spin on in the public consciousness. What has the Assembly of First Nations said? Nothing. Why? Because they don't know what to say. And I will say this here and now, that if Canada's native representatives don't do a lot of hard thinking between now and whatever they're going to do in South Africa, they're going to be blindsided on the issues of racism, too. It's one of those that bets that I can't lose, by the way. And I think that it's a sad commentary, not only on me, but on them. So what is there, what's to do? What's supposed to happen here? I pose that as a series of questions. Is there a point to going to Durban? I think it's a serious question. Should First Nations of any stripe, at a national level, local level, a traditional, non-traditional, ad hoc, non-governmental, self-constituted groups, should they be interested in going to Durban, South Africa? And my answer is, very simply, Canada can't be trusted to report accurately on the issues of racism in Canada. They can't be trusted. And it's interesting, I said that in Halifax, just as invited to a human rights conference, with two senators. I was sitting on what was called the senators panel. Me. Senator, Roland Christian. Ooh. Do they know something I don't know? I don't think so. But I was sitting on the senators panel and I made the same exact accusation that Canada picks and chooses those international laws it considers itself to be bound by and it doesn't discuss, doesn't talk about abrogation of those responsibilities otherwise. And do you know what the senators did? Did they get up and say, shame, shame, bad, evil person, unclean, unclean, get him out of here? The two senators agreed with me. And what they were pushing for was, what we need is a Senate committee that will oversee the legislation of the Canadian government and the implementation of the bureaucracy. This is what the error they were arguing for, and they asked me what I thought about that. And I said, are you saying that I can't trust Parliament and the Supreme Court and I can trust you? Well, that is a bit of a stretch, Professor Christian. they were perfectly willing to take my position. I think they had a bit of a self-interest in that they saw it as a leading naturally to their own self-interest of building another layer of bureaucracy. But it wasn't a controversial position that I had taken, at least as far as the senators of Canada are willing to say. So I don't think I was speaking out of line there. Canada simply can't be trusted on this. That there has to be some kind of, they asked me, well, what would I do if it wasn't a Senate review mechanism? I said, again, unless there's some forum internationally that Indigenous peoples can regularly hold Canada accountable to, then Canada will never make a decision that consciously goes against its own self-interests. I don't care where that is, it's not going to happen. And if Canada's willing to allow itself to be bound by an international forum, I'd see that as a better step than anything that we're likely to be able to do internally and locally. And they thank me for my opinion, but as you've probably seen, they've had 6 weeks since then, and there hasn't been this international movement to hold Canada accountable to a United Nations or a world court. So because Canada can't be held, can't be trusted, then I don't see an alternative to not doing something. All things being considered, it's probably better to go to Durban, South Africa and be ignored than not go to Durban, South Africa and be assured that Canada will lie in the absence of anybody who is going to be so rude as to stand up and say, liar. At the very least, if I was going, and by the way, I'm not interested in going, I don't want to go to Durban, South Africa, I wish I knew somebody who did, because I can feed you a lot of really great information, but what you've got to do is when you get there, is when the time is right, you have to stand up and shout at the top of your lungs, liar. That's your job. There's a real danger that the indigenous issues in North America, Canada, or the United States will be swamped, however, at that conference. Like I say, the conference is in its own way self-destructing right now. And the problems of the Palestinian people, it's not that they're taking the fishing rights away from the Palestinians or they're not letting them catch lobsters or whatever. It's that they're shooting and killing them and imprisoning them and torturing them. And the black reparations issues isn't because, I don't know, they're cutting back on band funds and they're looking at the administration a little bit too carefully. It's that thousands and thousands of lives were stolen, thousands and thousands of tons of raw materials were stolen, countries were expropriated, and so on and so on. In that sense, you'd have to say, well, you know, what are the Indians really complaining about? You know, compared to what some other groups apparently have to complain about, isn't it rather just like, mainly just an annoying kind of whine that is being emitted by indigenous people in North America? And there is a danger that a lot of people through the rest of the world are actually going to see it that way. Well, you've got to complain about it. It turns into one of those things, who's the most oppressed in this world? You think you're oppressed? Well, I was oppressed this way. Well, you two guys are pikers. You ever see that comedy routine where they're all one-upping themselves? Ha, you luxury, luxury. You had shoes as a child. We had to stand in mud until it got hard. Oh, you had mud. Oh, luxury, luxury. Yeah, you can get in one of those who's got the longest contest, and it's really quite self-defeating because you end up denigrating other oppressed people's quite reasonable objection, simply on the basis that, well, they're not nearly as oppressed as these other people were. Wouldn't like to see this kind of thing degenerate in that kind of a discussion. And there is a danger it would happen there. So like I say, it's a double-edged sword. Second question, is an opportunity to address the plenary the sine qua non of going? In other words, if you don't have a chance to talk to the plenary session, is it a waste of time to go? And my answer is no. What would be a waste of time to go is to go there and have your 15 minutes in the sun and have absolutely nothing to say. As I was saying just a little bit earlier, I consider that to be the real danger, that we're going to get some tongue-tied idiot up there. I represent the Aboriginal people of Canada, and it's not good. We don't like racism. I think racism is really, really bad. We should stop it. Thank you very much. Oh, incisive. Oh, critical. Oh, we can all rally behind that battle cry. It's not necessary to stand up in 15 minutes and talk. It would be just as important, whether or not you had to say it publicly, to have something to say. A lot of what's going to go on in Durban, South Africa, is that people are going to meet people. Like I say, you're going to Durban, South Africa, so that Canada can't lie with impunity. The way that they won't be able to lie with impunity is for you to be able to put into the hands of the people who will otherwise believe the lie, a refutation of those lies. This is what's going on. This is our take. Even if I don't get a chance to stand up and say it, this is the situation. And by the way, that's going to be fairly reasonably easy to do. Why? Because Ottawa is sharing its ongoing work toward the final documentation. You can go to their website and find out what it is they're saying and how it is that they're putting it together. As long as you're willing to take the time and the effort to read through and prepare yourself carefully, Canada will tell you what it's about to say down in Durban, South Africa. Notice that having that analysis also doesn't necessarily mean that you have to go. that it's going to be just as important, because everybody who's likely to be able to benefit from that analysis won't necessarily show up in Durban, South Africa. It would be nice to be there to hand it out and to repudiate a Canadian position if that Canadian position was offensive and irrelevant. It would be very nice. But it would also be greater to be able to put that paper in the hands of people worldwide. Here's our take. Here you can download what we have to say. Here is a website. Here is a, we can mail this out. You want a copy of the Indigenous people's take on the World Conference Against Racism and Canada, Racism Canada? Here it is. You don't have to go to Durban, South Africa to get it. You can get it right from me or from you or from you and so on. But again, there, what is important is the content, not the process. There's going to be at least one more roll-up conference. And the question that I wanted to get the Aboriginal Caucus to consider is whether or not they should participate in it. Why? For one thing, that the Aboriginal Caucus has talked about setting their own conference for the first week in May in Vancouver, which I was in favor of, until I began to realize I'm not going to get invited to that one. Not being a representative of a large enough group, I'm not going to, the eunuchs have passed judgment on me. And I was saying, look, we should really consider whether or not we should put the word out that no Indian should go to that conference, or that the Indians who go to that conference should be doing what the Indians have been doing at the conferences up till now, which is saying, this is not a consultation. Canada doesn't have the right to summarize what we're saying and representing it, make it possible for us to make our own point down in Durban, South Africa, and get out of our way. If that's what's going to happen, then we should send somebody to that conference, the Hetty Frey Conference in Winnipeg, so that we can say it again. So there is some point to going to that, if nothing more than to reinforce the position that has been coming up again and again and again at these other conferences. Can we place our hopes in the Indigenous representative organizations? And all I can say is maybe you can, but I can't. I don't trust the Indigenous representative organizations any more than I trust Hetty Frey. And I can't emphasize this more. It's not because I consider them evil people or bad people or whatever. It's because for whatever reason, whatever they're talking about in this loud silence is not Canadian racism. Okay, what is it? I'm talking around it a lot. Let me talk at it to finish this talk. So what's the real problem? The problem of Canadian racism, Indigenous peoples, is not a problem of bad attitudes and evil minds, although there are most definitely bad attitudes and evil minds enough to go around. Canada's racism is dictated by an economic order that maintains the legality of its expropriation of the lands, resources, and lives of Indigenous peoples by the pretense that they are not peoples, and consequently no more owners or direct descendants of the owners of this land than a bird owns the tree it nests in, or a moose owns the swamp that it stands in. Canada's stance in this area is the same one Columbus took in 1492. It is necessary to perceived self-interest of Canada, as it was to Columbus's perceived self-interest. That is the original basis of racism, economic expropriation of the lands, lives, and resources of the Aboriginal inhabitants, is as real and as important today as it was in 1492. No Canadian government or court or institution or interest group will ever acknowledge this self-interest, much less act to eliminate it or even to reduce it. The Canadian form of handling this problem has consistently been assimilation, which, if you read my book on residential schools, I say is a euphemism. The proper word is genocide, but let's use theirs. Their way of handling this has been assimilation, inducing Indigenous peoples by carrots and sticks to deny their nationhood, abandon their forms of life, and accept the great Canadian lie. We are to learn our place in somebody else's version of our lives, not pursue our own versions of it. The agenda set out by Heritage Canada explicitly furthers the Canadian variant of racism. Two quotes. These quotes were in a document that were given to me back in September. They have not changed since September. You go and you find out what Canada says on its draft report of its report to the plenary session at the World Conference Against Racism. These sentences haven't changed. Sentence one. This broad discussion, they're going to put a broad discussion together. They're going to get what they call the interested parties together and have a broad discussion of the issues of racism in Canada. This broad discussion among and between groups and communities across the country, we hope, will produce consensus on what we need to do at home to ensure that no Canadian is denied the opportunity to contribute fully to society because of intolerance, discrimination, or racism. That's one quote. The next page over. Individuals are prevented from reaching their full potential and making their unique contributions to society because of racism and intolerance. There's the definition, Canadian definition of what racism is. It's that there are some Canadians, the ones that we're going to call the racists out there, and those racists are not helping assimilate Aboriginal peoples quickly enough. If everybody was on side on this, the Indians would be assimilated by now. But those damn racists keep getting in the way. What we're going to do with Heritage Canada is to find those racists or to create programs that will smooth out that assimilation process. That's what they say is the problem of racism in Canada, that Indians haven't given up their ways quickly enough. Is there a clearer, more obvious misstatement of the problem and a furtherance of what I call the genocidal assimilationist agenda than that? Maybe it's not Hitler and cattle cars, but it's damn effective. It's damn effective when we can get our own supposedly Aboriginal representative agencies in on side on participating in that process. Even if we don't go, the World Conference Against Racism is an opportunity to break the whole, the ideology of false fairness that Canada imposes in subtle and obvious ways on Indigenous peoples. I and several of the students here, I'm reading this because I really want to say this exactly the way I've written it. I and several of the students here at St. Thomas University are engaged in the task of putting together, within the bounds of our own limitations, a serious analysis of the issues of Canadian racism in materialist terms. We hope to be able to make this available before and after the World Conference Against Racism to Indigenous groups or individuals who are interested in having something substantive to say in Durban, South Africa. It's time to draw a line in the sand. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Dr. Roland Christjohn speaking on The World Conference Against Racism, Canada's Loud Silence, recorded on March 22, 2001. This has been the Revolutionary Action Dance Party, produced out of CHSR FM in Fredericton. To contact us, email rad@chsr.net. Or call area code 506-453-4985. Thanks for listening.